Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we are talking about nuclear missiles. I know, it's been a stressful enough 12 months already for everyone listening, and so my apologies in advance. The short version of what we're discussing today is Utah's role in the pending overhaul of America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Those nuclear-tipped warheads in silos, waiting at the ready all the time, in case the President of the United States, whoever that may be, says go. But our current land-based missiles, the Minuteman III missiles, well, they're very old.
So the locations and the missile silos and launch complexes were designed during the Kennedy administration and built during the Kennedy administration. So that makes them more than half a century old.
That's Eric Schlosser, author of the book Command and Control, which details, at least in part, some of the issues with the aging infrastructure underpinning our nuclear arsenal, and which actually primarily documents, in fine and utterly terrifying detail, the too many nuclear catastrophes that almost were. We'll come back to Eric Schlosser in just a bit. First, though, we're headed to Hill Air Force Base for an overview of the overhaul of America's ICBMs. Colonel Jason Bartolome is director of the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent Systems Directorate with the U.S. Air Force's Nuclear Weapons Center at Hill Air Force Base. Bartolome is responsible for the development, deployment, and sustainment of the next-generation intercontinental ballistic missile system, an $83 billion undertaking when all is said and done. I spoke to Colonel Bartolome via Zoom on Monday.
Yeah, thanks, Roger.
Appreciate your being here. You are in charge of something that is happening up at Hill Air Force Base in northern Utah, the development of a facility that will become, as I understand it, and please clarify if this isn't the case, a kind of headquarters for America's ground-based nuclear weapons arsenal. Is that an accurate description of this facility, the mission integration facility of the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent Program?
Well, Roger, I think most people in Utah might not realize that since 1994, Hill Air Force Base, just north of Salt Lake City near Ogden, has really been the home of our nation's ICBM sustainment activities. And really, ever since the Air Force closed Norton Air Force Base in Southern California, right at the end of the Cold War, we've been the nucleus of our nation's land-based deterrent for all of these years. And it's only been really in the last about 7 years has the discussion and the activities associated with recapitalizing our ICBM force. And this project, we call it the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, has been here at Hill Air Force Base, sort of under the radar. And as recently as this last fall in September, we awarded Northrop Grumman a $13.3 billion development contract. And we are fast at really building this organization and quite a bit of work up here in northern Utah to begin in earnest the development and the replacement of our ICBMs.
Right. And this is a new weapons system, as you said, $13.3 billion. And I think that some people will know that our current intercontinental ballistic missiles, the Minuteman III, missiles are being phased out. Others won't. Still others won't even know what we're talking about. this is going to be extremely general for somebody who lives and breathes this stuff, Colonel Bartolome. But to the extent that you can, would you mind giving us that sort of broad overview of our nuclear weapons program, the triad, and you know where it is and where it's headed?
Oh, I'm happy to. So our nuclear triad consists of, probably no surprise to your audience, three different legs. We talked a bit about the land-based leg, which are the ICBMs. We also have the sea-based leg, which are our nuclear submarines that operate off our east and west coasts. And then we also have the air leg of the triad that includes our bombers. So the three different legs of the triad each have different characteristics. We call the submarine force our survivable leg of the triad because they're very hard for the adversary to know or detect where they are. we call the air-based leg of the triad, the flexible leg of the triad. And they have their own unique features. They can fly from stateside or in predefined locations, and they provide the president the maximum flexibility to conduct an operation. And then we call the ICBMs the responsive leg of the triad. And we have 450 missile silos located in the Mountain West in Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming. And those missiles stand at alert to deter our adversaries from aggression. You know, they have unique characteristics, both offensively to hold our adversaries' targets at risk. And then they have a very important feature from a defense perspective, because they provide well over 400 targets for the adversary. And really, they act as the barrier of entry for an adversary to threaten the United States, because they really do deter aggression, because it's very, very difficult for any of our adversaries to try to take out the ICBMs.
And so the ICBMs that we currently have are as the system that's going to come online as replacing the Minuteman III, which are kind of aging, right?
Yeah, Roger. So the Minuteman III have been on alert for over 50 years, and they'll remain on alert for another 20 years. So the Minuteman III has been just an absolute hall of fame and very effective weapons system for our country for so many years. And when it was designed, believe it or not, it was designed as a 10-year weapons system. And so when our forefathers deployed it, we thought that, you know, they'd be on alert for some time and then they'd be replaced by another system. And for the last 50 years, we've been operating these missiles, you know, very effectively and very safely, but it's just time to replace them. If you can imagine, for some of your audience that are interested in restoring antique cars, there's just a great analogy for keeping, you know, an antique automobile up and running. And the great airmen and the folks here at Hill Air Force Base have just done an incredible job for so many years. But as we look to the future, Roger, and we see how the threats are evolving, and we look to the next 50 years, we determined as a nation that it was time to replace this system with a new one that will be able to meet the challenges of the future security environment that we all see coming ahead.
There is some, I'm assuming, some testing that is going to have to occur for this new missile system to come online. Some of that testing is going to happen here in Utah, from my understanding. Maybe it's just components testing. I don't really know. Can you explain what that entails?
Oh, sure. So as one can imagine, a system of the size and scale of this project, there's going to be, you know, quite a bit of testing that will have to be conducted from the component level all the way to the operational system level. And from an operational system level, you know, we test these systems out at Vandenberg in California. And every year for the last several decades, we've tested about three or four of these missiles a year, and we launched them out into the Pacific Ocean area. And so at the component subsystem level, though, we do quite a bit of testing as we engineer and sustain the system. And so there'll be testing that goes on here in Utah, particularly here at Hill Air Force Base, and as well as our contractor facilities, to make sure the system is able to perform and do the mission that it's being called to do by our nation.
Will any of those actual test missiles, you know, be launched from Utah? I'm assuming they're all getting launched from Vandenberg.
Yeah, that's correct. So all of the missiles are launched out of Vandenberg. But there's quite a bit of work going on in the command and control area of the system. So as you can imagine, you know, if one were to think about a missile field, and again, there's three of them, you know, one up in Montana, one in North Dakota, and one in Wyoming. Each one of these missile fields are actually a pretty incredible landmass, Roger. I mean, they're the size of mid-Atlantic states when one takes a look at it from, say, a satellite photo. So if you were to imagine the state of Connecticut or the state of New Jersey or the state of Maryland, and if any of your listeners had ever visited, one of our missile wings is the size of that entire landmass. And those launch facilities and launch centers are all connected to each other. And the system acts, the missile wing acts as a living and breathing system that's able to respond and react in case we are ever under attack. And so there are a lot of important elements that, that you can test that aren't the missile here in Utah, like the command and control system and the physical security. And so we're doing quite a bit of work here in Utah to make sure that all those systems are functional and ready for action.
Okay. I know we're getting low on time, and so I want to ask a couple of questions. You know, we're designing a system that is expected to last for quite a while, another couple of generations. Can you explain how it's different from what it's replacing, the Minuteman III, and how does that sort of play in the larger context of nuclear warheads around the world, if you can talk about that?
Okay, so great question, Roger. So the way I would think about the GBSD is really as a new baseline for the ICBM. And the way we're building this system is to be a more flexible and easily modernizable system so that it's able to meet the challenges that we might face, you know, in 2020 or 2030 and beyond. And so quite a bit of energy, Roger, has gone into designing the system to be a modular system, to abide by sort of present day standards for how we design systems. And really the way we're looking at this system is to replace the Minuteman III with essentially, and for most observers, a system that looks and feels very similar to the system that's out there, but one that is more modular and easier to sustain. And if the nation requires, easier to upgrade, if that were something that we needed to do as a nation.
Is the new system just going exactly in the same silos as the old system? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to replace the missiles that are currently on alert and use the same silos. Now, we have to do some work on the silos to prepare them to receive the new missile. But essentially, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be operating the Minuteman III and replacing it with GBSD missiles to the tune of one a week for 9 years, if you can imagine. So this is really a mega project of epic proportions, and we'll be operating both systems. And then ultimately in the mid 2030s, we'll have transitioned to the new system and they'll be on alert and carrying on the mission that the nation is requiring.
I was going to ask for the time frame, and you just laid that out for us. The history of nuclear weapons development and what they are used or not used for is of interest, I think, to a lot of people. The fact that they are deterrent. I mean, it's in the name. They are deterrent, and they're not necessarily something that we ever want to use. Is that how you see it? These are weapons that we design, but that we don't really want to use?
Well, so I think the definition of deterrence is, you know, any action that discourages an action or event through instilling doubt or fear of the consequences. And so, you know, many believe that these are used every day in deterring an adversary that might ever think of doing harm to our country. And so, you know, I believe that these systems have been very effective in really keeping our nation and our national interests and our people in a position of safety, in discouraging any adversary who might not want what's best for us, what they might do. So I would say that they're being used every day, and these systems really are our foreign policy and our war plans. Really depend on this deterrent working, because if the deterrent fails, then we're in an entirely different situation than we are if they do their job.
Leverage is the word there. Colonel Jason Bartolome, Director of the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent Systems Directorate with the U.S. Air Force here at Hill Air Force Base, really appreciate your making time for this.
My pleasure, Roger.
Now on the show, we're going to zoom out for some greater context on America's nuclear weapons program. And actually, we're going to stretch this conversation into our next episode as well. Eric Schlosser is a journalist who wrote, among other things, the best-selling books Fast Food Nation, the dark side of the all-American meal, reefer madness, sex, drugs, and cheap labor in the American black market, and command and control, nuclear weapons, the Damascus accident, and the illusion of safety. And that book documents a number of utterly terrifying nuclear weapons catastrophes on U.S. soil that almost came to pass, from near accidental detonations on the ground to fatal accidents in silos that could have been much more fatal, to retaliatory strikes the U.S. almost launched in response to computer glitches, to the nuclear bomb accidentally dropped by the U.S. military on North Carolina that, by seeming sheer luck, didn't explode, and many other terrifying incidents. The book also examines America's and the world's aging nuclear weapons infrastructure. And to begin with, I asked Schlosser about the $83 billion transition from the Minuteman missiles to the coming next generation of ICBMs. Just before we talk about investing in a new system, one part of your book, Command and Control, talks about just how old the Minuteman missiles are. Can you sort of lay that out for us? Just, I don't know, how decrepit those missiles are, if that makes sense?
Well, the silos and the launch complexes for the Minuteman were designed during the Kennedy administration and built during the Kennedy administration. So that makes them more than half a century old. And these locations were chosen at the height of the Cold War, when it was assumed that the missiles would be used against the Soviet Union. So that's why they're located where they're located. And that's a real problem in the 21st century, because if you want to hit a target outside of Russia, you still have to fly over Russia with one of these missiles. And you cannot assume that Vladimir Putin and the Russians are going to know that that missile is going somewhere else and not going to Moscow. So when you think about whether or not to have a ground-based strategic deterrent, the first question should be, why would you put the missiles in locations that were selected 50 to 60 years ago for war with the Soviet Union? The next question would be, why would you have a missile that cannot be moved? Both Russia and China have missiles, and North Korea have missiles that are mobile. So we're never 100% sure of where they are, which makes it more difficult to destroy those missiles. If you put the new missiles in the United States into silos that are 50 to 60 years old, everyone knows where they're located, and they could be easily destroyed. They could be destroyed not only by Russian nuclear weapons, but they could be destroyed by domestic terrorists. And one of the things that's extraordinary, and I've driven around the missile fields, the Minuteman missile fields, is most of these missiles are located in areas surrounded by private land. In Russia and China, they put their missiles on military bases. In the United States, our Minuteman missiles are in silos that have thousands of acres of farmland surrounding them. What that means is there are 5,000 miles of cables that link our launch control centers with our missile silos, and those cables are going across private land. These missiles are so vulnerable to sabotage, and now increasingly to being hacked into.
Right. But cybersecurity threats, I mean, you talked about destroying them, you know, in advance. Of course, there's just the idea that they could simply be made inoperative by a stealthy hack.
Right. And the idea of hacking into our nuclear command and control system sounds like the plot of an old Hollywood movie, but it is a real concern. And people much smarter than me and with much more knowledge of this issue are deeply, deeply concerned about it. So I think the question that should be posed to supporters of the ground-based strategic deterrent is, if you were going to start from scratch, would you really locate these missile silos where they are right now? The answer would be no. Would you really use 5,000 miles of cable to connect them to the launch centers that's going over private land? I think the answer would be no. One of the defenses of using these old silos today is that it turns the upper Midwest into a warhead sink. And believe it or not, what that strategy is that it's drawing an attack on the United States, on the heartland of the United States. And the logic is that in order to destroy these missiles, the Russians or the Chinese would have to attack the heartland of the United States. And by attacking the heartland of the United States, they would guarantee an overwhelmingly destructive retaliation by American nuclear weapons. But if that's the logic, then why not put one missile in New York City, one missile in Washington, D.C., and maybe three missiles in, well, I was going to make a joke about a city I don't like. But but if your goal is to invite an attack on the United States in order to threaten a retaliation, you don't need 400 missiles to do that.
This is a different topic altogether, but you know, you talked about the rationale behind doing it the way we've been doing it, putting them in the same silos. Former Defense Secretary William Perry at one point argued against the development of this program altogether, saying that it would lead essentially to a new arms race with Russia and China because it would be, despite those drawbacks that you're describing, it would be a leap forward in terms of speed and accuracy. Is an arms race where we're headed?
I think that we're in the arms race, and Bill Perry is extraordinary, and he's one of the few people alive today who was in a position of authority at the height of the Cold War. So he knows this from firsthand experience. And one of Bill Perry's greatest concerns is that when missiles are vulnerable to attack, like these ground-based missiles would be, you're under enormous pressure to use them or lose them. And again, this sounds like the plot of a Hollywood movie, but that creates an enormous risk of accidental nuclear war. Right now, the United States has the capacity to launch our Minutemen missiles under warning. That means that these missiles could be launched simply when there is a warning that the United States is under attack. And we've had a number of, you know, false alarms from our early warning system. One of the unusual and unique aspects about these Minuteman missiles is once they're launched, they cannot be called back. And one of the arguments that Perry makes that I think is very convincing is that nuclear submarines are hidden beneath the ocean and therefore are under no immediate pressure to launch their missiles. There's much more time available for decision making. If it looks like the United States is under attack and it turns out to be a false alarm, these submarines hidden beneath the ocean don't have to launch their missiles. The same is true for our bombers. Once bombers get off the ground, if it turns out to be a false alarm, you can order them to return to their base. But because of the vulnerability of the Minuteman, there's enormous pressure to launch the missiles if there's a fear that they're about to be destroyed. And what you want during a nuclear crisis is you want as much time as possible for decision-making. So I think as I've said earlier, I think the advocates of the ground-based strategic deterrent need to make a case for why missiles should be put in silos that are more than half a century old with cables that are vulnerable to disruption, with a missile, with a weapon system that could potentially cause an accidental nuclear war.
It's a terrifying prospect, and I mean, I guess the it begs a question that you may not be able to answer, but which is why, you know, we have the nuclear triad. We have land, we have sea, we have air. Why do we have to have the triad? I mean, why is having, the question I have is why is it happening?
Yeah, it's happening because it's very hard to break out of old molds of thinking. And these are weapons that were carefully, skillfully, brilliantly designed for the last war, for the Cold War. And by the way, they're actually excellent weapons for a surprise attack on Russia because they can be launched within minutes. They travel extremely quickly and they're very, very accurate. And if you're not worried about them being destroyed, but you want to use them as a surprise attack, They're excellent for that reason. I think that just the fact that they're being located in these 60-year silos show you that they're a legacy of the Cold War.
Yeah.
The other reason that there's such pressure to build them is that it's a multi-billion dollar program. It will bring billions of dollars to Hill Air Force Base and to Montana and North Dakota. And the senators of these states strongly support them. I would hope that if you're looking for federal funding for economic development, that you could find other projects that wouldn't put a bullseye on your state and invite a nuclear attack on your state. Because again, these targets, these missiles are sitting ducks. There's no way to defend them.
Can we zoom out and talk about something that I think most people rarely, if ever, think about, which is the concept of deterrence, the sort of baffling idea behind nuclear weapons that, look, we don't want to use them. We don't ever want to use them. In general, they are not supposed to be used because it's sort of unfathomable what nuclear war would look like. I guess, do you want to describe that? I mean,
the whole realm of nuclear strategy has all kinds of phrases that are innocuous sounding that are actually designed to hide what they really mean. Nuclear deterrence is another way of saying hostage taking. Right now, the United States is threatening to kill, essentially, the civilians of Russia if Russia attacks us. And Russia is doing the same thing to the United States. Nuclear deterrence is a threat to annihilate your enemy if they attack you with nuclear weapons. It's very much like medieval hostage taking. One of the sad things about deterrence is that it usually works. I think that nuclear deterrence played a major role in preventing a war with the Soviet Union. I think nuclear deterrence played a major role in preventing World War III. The problem with nuclear deterrence is that it works until it doesn't. It's not like a brick wall that prevents, you know, someone with a spear from climbing over it. It's a psychological defense, and it only works against people who have a desire to live. We now have adversaries that celebrate the killing of civilians and are willing to die for it. And nuclear deterrence was never designed for that kind of adversary. Nuclear deterrence was also created as a theory when there was a superpower rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, who basically controlled all the nuclear weapons in the world. And now there are seven other countries that have nuclear weapons. And so you have a much, much more complex nuclear rivalry. You have India and Pakistan and China, the old nuclear powers of France and the United Kingdom. You also have Israel, North Korea. And this is a much more challenging, much more complex dynamic, which calls into question whether nuclear weapons are relevant at all in the 21st century. So I think we need to be asking much more basic questions about why we have these weapons, how they might be used, and what's the theory behind them in the 21st century, and not just rebuilding an arsenal that has its intellectual origins really in the 1950s.
Eric Schlosser is a journalist and author of Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. On our next show, we'll hear more from Eric Schlosser on the process in place that allows the President of the United States to launch a nuclear strike without any way for others to intervene. And we'll delve into the efforts to abolish nuclear weapons around the globe. And we'll hear about one of the many accidents that Schlosser documents in harrowing detail in his book. Just before we wrap up, we began the show in conversation with Colonel Jason Bartolome with the U.S. Air Force. When it comes to the officers who maintain and oversee our nuclear arsenal, Eric Schlosser has this to say.
I've spent an enormous amount of time with the Air Force, and I've spent an enormous amount of time with the officers who have command and control of our nuclear weapons. I have tremendous respect for them. They do not fit the Hollywood stereotype of mad bombers eager to start World War III. And so none of my criticism of our current nuclear strategy applies to the officers who serve, who have an incredibly stressful job overseeing weapons that are out of date and aging and are prone to accidents.
That does it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent, local public radio resource. Find podcasts wherever you get your podcasts or over at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.